This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Although humans of different colors have been with us since the very beginning, it took thousands of years for them to be categorized according to race. Prior to the 18th century, people simply chalked up the differences in our appearances to geography, culture. It was Northern Europeans who invented the concept of race. Worse, they also decided that white-skinned people had distinct advantages over those of other colors. And as the concept spread across the Atlantic, ways were invented to determine exactly who was and who was not white, all with tragic socioeconomic consequences. This is dealt with in the current exhibit about race at Discovery Place, but it is extensively examined in the current book, The History of White People, written by our guest this hour, Princeton historian Nell Irvin Painter, who joins us by phone from Newark, New Jersey. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We've also invited one of your students to join us here in our Spirit Square studio. Yeah, Dr. Cheryl Hicks is an assistant professor of history at UNC Charlotte, who studied with Dr. Painter while at Princeton, and she teaches American, African-American, and women's history at UNC Charlotte, and is the author of her own book, Talk With You Like a Woman. Welcome to the program as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're not going to be intimidated by Dr. Painter, are you now?
Not at all.
two very casual observations about this book to start with. It's the first book that I can remember in about, 20 years of doing this kind of stuff on the radio that has no subtitle. It's just the history of white people. How did you get away with that?
The history of white people was, the working title was Constructions of White Americans from Antiquity to the Present.
Okay.
And people kept saying, what's that? And I would say, the history of white people. And they say, oh. So we did it for clarity.
Okay. And it's a pretty provocative title, so I guess that's why it doesn't require anything to as a subtitle, although it's also the first book I've ever seen where on the dust jacket, on the spine, is not only the title of the book and the name of the author and publisher, but an entire paragraph talking about what's inside the book. So I guess that that replaces the subtitle, I guess.
In a sense, it does. And what goes down the spine of the hardcover is usually flap copy.
Okay, yeah.
It's the flap copy starts on the dust jacket and then continues in the flap copy in the dust jacket.
Now,
in the soft cover, the copy on the spine is one of my reviews.
Okay. I mentioned the exhibit at our local science museum, which is right across the street from where we're sitting now and about a block away from where you'll be tomorrow. It's Discovery Place, which that exhibit on race busts the myth of race, a component of which is a short history of white people. Is there some significance to the timing of both these lessons on race? Is there something going on in the world today that has caused both these things to come out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going on there in Charlotte, but my sense of the zeitgeist is that things have been changing since about the late 90s. And I think those changes, which are related to immigration and African-American mobility and education, globalization, spread of lots of different kinds of people in the suburbs and so on and so forth, those changes, which are long-term changes, I think made possible the election of Barack Obama, but also have changed what we in art call the iconography of American culture. So in the 20th century, it was the American, and he was a sort of Nordic-looking white man.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you have the Americans, plural, with lots of different people and a multicultural or diverse base of American culture. So these are big changes.
You begin this history of white people 2,000 years ago. This goes way back with the Greeks, and others of the time who lived around the Mediterranean. They did not see themselves as white back then.
Well, I mean, they could look at themselves and say, actually, they saw themselves as a beautiful intermediate kind of color. They could see human difference. But it didn't mean the same thing. So when the savants of ancient Greece looked to explain the differences between human groups, they looked to what we would call culture and environment. So people from cold, boggy places had cold, boggy bellies and so forth. So as you said in your intro, the invention of racial classification and the way that we think of it is about 300 years old or so. Mm-hmm. So it was invented much after what we think of as the history of Western.
They were not, back then, and up until about the 18th century, they were not really concerned about, they didn't think in terms of race. They did think in terms of the other. People not
sure.
like themselves. And
it was
interesting to look and read in your book the various ways people describe people from other places, because the world was much more insular back then. There was no air travel, of course, and so when they ran into somebody from another place, they were truly foreign in every way.
Well, it's somebody like Herodotus, who was a traveler who went around looking at people and explaining difference. So in Western civilization, going back, say, 2,000, 3,000 years, the big differences are, first of all, for the Greeks, level of civilization. They considered themselves civilized and all the rest barbarians for various reasons.
Right.
And then after 1,000 or so, the big divide is over religion, whether it's Muslim, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, and so forth, or Catholic, Protestant. So those are big differences, how people saw other people as being fundamentally different from themselves. And let me just sort out one thing you said, though, in your intro, and that is that skin colors have not been with us from all time. The original Homo sapiens were Africans, and they lived in a hot place, and they had dark skin. Dark skin was already a change from our hairy ape ancestors who had light skin under hair. So when people lost their hair, they had to get some other kind of protection, which was dark skin. But as people moved, and people have been moving and are still moving is a characteristic of people, depending on where they were, the melanin in their skin adjusted to the level of ultraviolet radiation. That's the driver of different skin colors.
Mm.
And ultraviolet radiation, vitamin D, has to do with the formation of your bones, the formation of fetuses, protection against skin cancer, and so on and so forth. So if you get too much, you're in trouble. But if you don't get enough, you're in trouble.
I want to go back to some of the descriptives that people used about the others that they ran into in their travels or who came to visit their small part of the world, because they're remarkable. You mentioned soft-bellied or wet-bellied people a second ago. Give me some of the other descriptives that people have used to describe people other than themselves.
Well, there was a whole category of people who were beings who were considered people who were monsters. So on page 26, for instance, actually I put in four of my own drawings of these people. So the Cyclops sort of figure has one great big eye, and another has a foot that's so big he can pull it over his head, given the shade. And another has ears that are so long he can wrap them around his arms. So even for Linnaeus, writing in the middle of the 18th century, these folks were also part of humankind. So it wasn't simply whether or not you lived in a craggy place and then you were energetic, or you lived in a wonderful middling place like Greece or Rome and you were perfect and beautiful, or you lived in a deserty place and so you were dry. Those are all different ways of figuring out human difference.
But there were also descriptors that we would probably use today, that certain parts of people from certain parts of the world were described as being I'm going to have to paraphrase this now, but as having a great musculature. They had, you know, the six-pack stomach and the nice biceps, et cetera, shoulders, broad shoulders. Others were fleshy. And they were ascribed to being, because they were from where they came from.
That's right.
The environment in which they lived. Why were those generalizations made? Because surely they were generalizations.
Well, why were any generalizations made? You know, one of the things about scientific racism in the 19th and early 20th centuries is that they would pick one person as a type, mm-hmm. and that person would stand for the type of whatever. I can't see you, so I have no idea what you look like. But by this way of thinking, if you were the person whom I, as a scientist, encountered, you could become the type of Charlotte, and you would stand for the 700,000 people who live in the fast-growing metropolis of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Well, since Dr. Cheryl Hicks is here from UNC Charlotte, she can testify to the accuracy of that statement.
Well, if I ran into her, she could be the type.
Well, that's true.
Of Charlotte person.
Oh, talk to me about, just a second, Dr. Hicks, about studying with Nell Painter, our guest on the phone here this morning, because as I said before we started the program, as you read through this book, The History of White People, which is accessible to the average person, it's not some academic tome that you're not going to be able to follow. What struck me is the incredible detail that we go through. If she brings up a person, for instance, the editor of the Saturday Evening Post in the 1920s, you, by the time you turn the third or fourth page, you will know everything you need to know about that person and why they're...
No, you will not know everything, believe me. You just know a teeny, teeny, weeny, weeny bit.
So talk to me about her approach toward teaching and how you learned from her.
Well, one of the things that I think has been really important for me in working with Professor Painter is the way in which she pushed me to think about different kinds of questions that you need to pose as a scholar, mm-hmm. and particularly the ways in which questioning the existing understanding of a particular topic can allow for really exciting historical research as well as writing. So we know, or we have a sense, that Dr. Painter in part began this project by asking this really broad question of why are white people called Caucasian? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of questioning and that push toward doing that influenced the ways in which I began my first book, Talk With You Like a Woman. Mm-hmm. So that book resulted from my investigations into a series of questions. And so, for instance, I'm focusing on working class black women in turn of the century New York. And so one set of questions were, if you place these women at the center of the urban narrative and the urban North and New York particularly, what does that story look like? Is it the same story that other scholars have addressed? And if a gendered perspective makes a difference, what kind of difference does it make?
I think it's interesting that you talk about teaching how to ask questions and questioning the norm. And that's what this book does. It answers a lot of questions that you may have posed or thought, maybe that you haven't thought about, but as you read through it, you think, well, I wonder why we've always thought that. And you'll get the answer. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the history of white people in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, a fourth-generation garage door technician offering local, comprehensive garage door service for over 11 years, including repairs and door installations. Details and appointments, 704-661-9070. Well, exercise, we've heard this before, but exercise keeps your body in shape. It has a positive effect on your mind as well. And your brain functions better, it seems, when you exercise. And exercise helps reduce depression and anxiety. Our guest tomorrow talks about this. Dr. John Rady of the Harvard Medical Center says he has discovered a special brain-nourishing protein, something he calls Miracle-Gro for the brain. He'll talk about that and how it relates to physical exercise and excelling in school tomorrow at 9. Our guest today speaks tomorrow, April 14th at 6 at the Levine Museum of the New South, and we will continue our conversation with Nell Irvin Painter in just a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, women's health, politics, and the federal budget, why Planned Parenthood and D.C.-funded abortions became key bargaining chips in threats to close the federal government.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University and the author of a recent book called The History of White People. Dr. Cheryl Hicks is also with us, one of Dr. Painter's students from a while ago, who now teaches history herself at UNC Charlotte. When we look back at modern history, we see repeated instances of the justification of white dominance over darker-skinned people because in the white people's point of view, historically, those with darker color skin were less civilized. And one of the things you learn early on in this book, and it was very surprising to me, you point out that when you go back 2,000 years, before race was a concept, it was lighter-skinned people who were considered to be less civilized. Talk about that.
Well, when we go back 2,000 years, you are in the center of the Mediterranean. Actually, you're kind of in the Eastern Mediterranean. And those are the people who were producing the texts that made intellectual history. And so they said that what they were was the best. And other people, and they were looking north, paler people who needed more ultraviolet radiation and so had less melanin in their skin. And they were living in the forest and the bogs. So
were they wrong?
Well, it depends on your criteria. One of the points that I want to make there is that it's not simply racial science stands on its own, but who is speaking, when, to whom, and for what purpose. So for what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And for the Greeks and the Romans, it was to make themselves look good. And I would add, 2,000 years later, for the Germans or the American people who considered themselves Anglo-Saxons, their own people. So the classifications change. I do want to say, though, that in the United States, it's very easy for us to think of race as being people of color, notably people of African descent. This is not the topic of my book. I do not talk about what people who considered themselves white did to people whom they considered non-white. That is not the topic of my book. What I do is talk about the changing ways of thinking of peoples whom we consider white. So that for a long time, whiteness was not the end of the discussion. There were races within white. So, for instance, in the middle of the 19th century, when there were large numbers of impoverished Irish immigrants to the United States, they were considered white. There was no question of that. Adult men could vote, and that's important. However, they were also racialized as an inferior white race, the Celtic race, as opposed to the Saxons or Anglo-Saxons. By the early 20th century, with new waves of impoverished immigrants, they in turn were racialized in two ways. One as the Italian race or the Hebrew race or the Slavic race and so forth, or as people who tested badly on the newfangled mental test. So the racial classification changed, but there were races within whiteness that could be ranked. And that's more what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and some of these concepts of this fear of immigration and the fear of mongrelizing and therefore diluting the success of America which was in the view of these people started by a certain breed of Anglo-Saxon, breed of Anglo-Saxon white people from England, and that did not include the Irish.
It did not include the Irish, and it also did not include people who were thought to have been, and the word was crackers or scum and dregs, people who had been forcibly transported, mm-hmm. or people, poor white people, often rural people, who were considered degenerate families because they were poor and they didn't necessarily get married before they had their children. So there were lots of ways to try to explain inferiority within even Anglo-Saxons. But the idea that there were distinctions within whiteness, that's crucial.
Yeah.
And our idea of one big white race in which everybody's equal dates from about the
1940s, 50s, and 60s. We lost you there. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay.
The idea of one big white race, ethnicities within.
One of the things that comes through loud and clear in this throughout the book is the constant morphing of the concept of race.
Yeah.
And who is defining it along the way? And what really shocked me was that, at least in the early 20th century, the media played a key role in this, particularly a magazine that I viewed all my life as completely innocuous. And that would be the Saturday Evening Post.
Saturday Evening Post.
Unbelievable what they talk about.
Deeply anti-Semitic.
Deeply, yes, I would say so.
Yeah.
There was a fellow named Kenneth Roberts who was hired by a man named George Lorimer, who was, I guess, the editor of the Saturday
That's
Evening
right.
Post at the time. And this is the magazine, people have to remember, that hired Norman Rockwell to paint their covers for almost their entire history, it seems, which gives you this impression of great Americana, albeit great white Americana.
Also, they have long heads. They're all Anglo-Saxon.
Yes. So you quote Roberts in here late in the book, and he's the guy that was hired to write for Saturday Evening Post. And the immigration situation has reared its ugly head again in America. People are very concerned about immigration. And you write here, agreeing with his editor Lorimer three times in one article, Roberts termed immigration restriction a matter of life and death for the American people. The threat was racial. Either the United States would break up into a series of racial groups fighting, bickering, haggling over their alien racial differences, or worse, a new composite race of people wholly different from the Americans of the present day would emerge. A motley, inefficient, mongrelized race. Now, this sounds relatively familiar. Is that because current-day people are quoting this, or because they're coming to the same conclusions?
They're reacting with the same kind of fears and seeing them within the scope of the same culture, and our culture is deeply racialized. So, in the early 20th century, when those words were written in the 1920s, race was considered to be the motivating factor, the engine of human history. So everything could be explained in that way.
Now, also underlining your premise that this book is not about white people versus black people when it comes to race. Once again, Roberts, writing in the Saturday Evening Post, says he describes Czechs as backward, illiterate, dirty, thick-headed, and English working men as runty, stunted, malformed, buck-toothed, obviously malnourished, diseased, and generally wretched specimens. Southern Italians had descended from the mongrelized slaves of the Roman Empire, and because the American nation, like ancient Greece and Rome, grew out of blonde Nordic genius, mongrelization would ruin the United States as surely as it ruined the ancients. Wow.
Well, there he was a very angry man. Roberts was a rock-rimmed conservative reactionary, I would say. And he hated Franklin Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. So he was also a big smoker. smoker and drinker.
Yes, and go ahead.
In those days, everybody was, I suppose, but he really did it. So he used a big clamshell as an ashtray, and he glued a Franklin Roosevelt dime to it so he could snuff out his cigarettes in Roosevelt's face.
How would you use this book in your classes, Dr. Hicks? I mean, this seems to be although it's not strictly a textbook, it's not a textbook at all. It could easily be used.
Well, there are at least two ways, I think, that I might be able to use the book. And one would clearly be an American history survey course spanning from 1865 to the present. And it would be really helpful for students to understand the challenges that immigrants faced and how change over time allowed for particular groups that were considered inferior or alien to be considered white or legitimate and American. And so as Dr. Painter talks about these four enlargements of American whiteness, that would be something that I think students would really learn about American history through this text. There's another course that I teach, a liberal studies course, where I look at American freedom from the perspective of African Americans. And I think with that course, there are various elements of this enlargement of American whiteness that would be important for students in terms of understanding how one non-white group, and that would be black people, struggled to be considered or treated human, as well as experience first-class citizenship when they were no longer categorized as slaves, and that once they gained these rights, that they were constantly challenged to have those rights enforced. So the ways in which we can kind of think about what American freedom means and who has access to that is one of the things that I think this text can really help students with.
If we took an honest look at the people like Mr. Roberts who were writing in the Saturday, he was writing in the Saturday Evening Post in the early 1900s, and we looked at and we could quantify them, how many people would be included in that group of people who felt superior to not only blacks, but felt superior to the Irish, to the Czechs, to the Italians?
Yeah.
How many people would be in that group? How exclusive a group would it have been?
Well, it would not have been an exclusive group. However, those with Robert's particular brand of vituperation, that was unusual. That was very unusual. But the anxiety over the immigrant masses was pretty widespread. And as you pointed out, you think of the Saturday Evening Post as part of popular culture, and it was. It was the most widely circulated magazine of the early 20th century. So, and it held on to that. It didn't lose its position because of the extremely racist views of its star writer and of the position that the editor took. The editor, in his editorial column, praised the eugenicists who were writing really mean-spirited books about people we would now consider poor white people, and they were considered alien races, that is to say the Slavic race, the Jewish race, and so forth. So it was a mainstream view that there were different kinds of white people, different races of white people, and they could be ranked. And one of the motives of quantifying that was the mental testing during the First World War and mental testing of immigrants from about 1913. So the science was showing that the immigrants were mentally inferior.
You have some example questions of those mental tests somewhere in this book. I'm not going to be able to find them right now. But I looked at the questions, and I didn't think that they were terribly difficult questions to answer. Were they terribly difficult questions to answer for those who were being given the test, or were they simply not well described to people who didn't speak the language?
The images there are for people who didn't read and write.
Here we go. I got them.
But the point was that you would have to be within the culture to know the answer. So if you were an immigrant coming from Puglia, for instance, how were you going to know about pipes or Congress, or, you know, or electricity and so forth. So they were very much culturally specific. And the scientist who wrote about them said that, no, because this came up at the time. Hey, wait. People do better the longer they stay in the United States. And the scientist said, no, that's not what's going on. It's that we were getting a better kind of immigrant earlier on, and the ones we're getting now are dumb or are intrinsically dumb. So they won't get any better.
Is that because scientists had an agenda back then, or because the scientific method was not as honed and precise as it might, as we consider it to be today?
The scientist in question had a message. One of the things I noted was that the people who wrote most energetically about race and permanent racial differences, first of all, were invariably male, invariably upper class, and usually quite conservative in their politics. So the revolution, the French Revolution, for instance, spawned a whole category of writing about race, and even more than that, the revolutions of 1848. So Gobineau, for instance, wrote looking back at the revolution of 1848 and saying, hey, look, if we don't sort this thing out, we're going to have more revolutions. So it was the idea of change, of abrupt change, and the idea of poor and working people taking over. So Bolshevism was considered a racial trait in the period after the First World War.
I have found the mental test questions in the book here.
Yeah.
Mental tests were meant to, as you say, appraise the value of a man. This is around 1917. These questions come from 1917 when U.S. Army draftees who could read answered questions like, why do soldiers wear wristwatches rather than pocket watches? Because they keep better time, they are harder to break, they are handier. I presume the question, the answer is C, handier, but here's a question I couldn't answer. Glass insulators are used to fasten telegraph wires because...
Yeah.
The glass keeps the pole from being burned. The glass keeps the current from escaping. The glass is cheap and attractive. And I think the answer is none of the above, but I could be wrong.
Well, I thought it was A. But there's our point, because we no longer have glass insulators. And so our culture doesn't give us that experience.
Interesting. and I want to go back. It's some of it is about, well, I have to take a break in a second, so I don't want to launch into something that I can't go into before the break. But I do want to go back to the Age of Enlightenment, which may be an oxymoron when it comes to we'll talk about it. When it comes to racial profiling, etc. We're talking to Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, who's a Princeton historian and the author of The History of White People. Also, Dr. Cheryl Hicks is with us, one of Dr. Painter's former students who now teaches at UNC Charlotte. She's an assistant professor of history there. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, introducing the 2011 Acura MDX with a 300-horsepower V6 engine and standard all-wheel drive. An array of financing options, virtual tours, HendrickAcura.com. Women's health, politics, and the federal budget, why Planned Parenthood and D.C.-funded abortions became key bargaining chips in threats to close the federal government last week. That's the topic of discussion today at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about the history of white people with Nell Irvin Painter, the author of that book, and Dr. Cheryl Hicks from UNC Charlotte, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
See the comedy Dead Man's Cell Phone with WFAE. It's the story of a ringing phone, mortality, and connecting in a technologically obsessed world. And after the show, there will be a talkback about how long you live electronically after death. We'll be there Thursday evening, April 14th. Ticket information is at actorstheatercharlotte.org.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today by phone from New Jersey is Nell Irvin Painter, professor of history and the author of The History of White People, which is not a black-white book necessarily, although it does touch on that. It's about the various degrees of whiteness over the years and what it meant to be white at various times, because it changes. Dr. Cheryl Hicks is also with us, an assistant professor of history at UNC Charlotte and author of Talk With You Like a Woman. Age of Enlightenment, let's go back to that, because you start with the Greeks, you go through the whole last 2,000 years here, and the Romantic era, etc. Americans and Europeans began to use skin color as a measure of race at that time. What was driving that at that time, Dr. Painter?
Well, two things were going on. One was skin color, or pigmentation generally, hair and so forth,
mm-hmm.
And the other is measurement. So both things were going on.
They were measuring skulls, right?
They were measuring skulls. They were measuring everything. But skulls surged to the fore as a premier measurement in the early 20th century. And, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, anthropologists throughout the Western world were busily measuring skulls and trying to correlate those with pigmentation and hair, you know, hair color, skin color, how tall were you, how broad was your nose, and tens of thousands of measurements produced chaos. And they kept saying, well, we need more measurements. And finally, the measurements fell out of favor, largely because they produced chaos, but also because Franz Boas, who is considered the father of cultural anthropology, showed that skulls changed, that skull measurement responded to the environment. And so the great innovation of the mid-20th century was understanding that race by itself was not everything,
mm-hmm.
that culture and language also counted.
But what was driving this frantic measurement scheme? Why were they so interested? Was it simply human curiosity, or were they trying to prove a point?
Both. Depends on who you're talking to and when. But largely, in the best sense, it was science and the will to taxonomize mm-hmm. the world around us. So there were measurements not just of people, but of plants and animals and oceans and mountains, and everything was being measured.
But the Age of Enlightenment comes about, coincides with the discovery of the New World by European explorers.
Well, it comes a couple of years.
Okay, but they're meeting new people that they've never seen before, and who they're trying to conquer and colonize, and then you have the beginnings of the African slave trade to the Northern American continent, another instance where Europeans are subjugating people of other colors to their will and to their uses.
Well, human beings will subjugate whoever they can. And one of the things I wanted to show is that race is not the driving force. Race comes afterwards as an explanation of the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the African slave trade, for instance. That goes back to the need for sugar and the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople and the closing off of the millennia-old slave trade from the Black Sea region. So, and the Vikings, for instance, were premier slavers. You know, we romanticized the Vikings, but they were acting like warlords the world over.
Hmm.
And raiding for slaves, unfortunately, is something that people do as long as they can get away with it.
And the Romans had slaves. They weren't black slaves necessarily. They were slaves of every... But did they?
Julius Caesar enslaved the people whom he defeated in Gaul because they were worth money.
But were
so
they?
And he would ship them back to Rome to finance his exploits in Rome.
But in those cultures, did they find? Were they searching for ways to justify the subjugation? The way it seems, at least it appears, and maybe it's not true, but it appears that in the Age of Enlightenment forward, that we're constantly looking for ways to prove that the people we have enslaved or subjugated are lesser than.
Oh, deserve it. Yeah.
Yes.
And so even Aristotle says that, you know, there's a slave personality, and
okay,
those people are inferior to us.
So it's always been with us.
So whenever somebody theorized it, they could figure out a way. And with the Age of Enlightenment in the 18th century, and categorizing the peoples of the earth and the sub, we would call them sub-races and so forth, then race became a way of doing it,
so when
justifying
you,
the
so, way. So when you get to the 20th century, when it's not just about black versus white, it's about the degree of whiteness, and not just the color of whiteness,
no,
but the degree of what constitutes
yes,
you as a
yes,
white person. The concept what, of superiority, the concept of beauty comes into play as well. What was driving that?
Well, I said at one point here that theories to explain why things are, it's something in them, the people who were at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that we can find over and over again. And an explanation for why people are at the top. And one of those explanations has to do with desirability. And so beauty is the index of desirability. So over and over again, the scientists are talking about measurements, but they're also talking about beauty. Emerson, for instance, goes on and on and on about how beautiful Saxon men are.
This is Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Ralph Waldo Emerson.
And he arrived at that conclusion because...
Well, he dug up... Some ancient texts saying that ancient Saxons were beautiful, and he also had been to Britain, and he looked around and he said, by God, these Saxons are beautiful, meaning English people.
Right. But later on, not all English people would be considered beautiful, as Mr. Roberts points out in the Saturday Evening Post.
That's another person talking another time for another audience for another reason.
Did anybody argue about with these leading voices, Ralph Waldo Emerson
yes,
in his time
yes,
and Roberts in his
yes,
time?
Yes, yes. There was always there were always contesting voices, and I try to capture those as well. But as in the 1920s, for instance, the contesting voices were rather muted. They come to the fore in the 30s largely because the Nazis showed how really awful those ideas, those racist ideas could be. And so one of the prime messages of the 1940s and 50s is that there are not different races within the Caucasoid race. There are really only three races, Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid, in that order. And there is no such thing as a Jewish race. But it took the Nazis to really show how far things could go.
And again, this was about the right kind of whiteness with them. Is that correct? With the Nazis?
The right races. I mean, there were races
okay,
within... the white race.
Yes, exactly.
To talk about the white race is only to use terminology that makes sense after the 1940s and 50s. It doesn't make sense before then.
As you went through the research, because you must have done an incredible, I can't even fathom the amount of research you did.
Thank heaven for the Princeton Library.
But as you went through this, as I read through it, it seems that we are obsessed with this. We have been historically obsessed with whiteness and with power and the power and superiority of the right brand of whiteness. And that would include where you came from, your socioeconomic background, being Protestant, not Catholic, etc. Are there other races other parts of the world where black people, where Asian people are obsessed with their being at the top of the pecking order?
Yeah, the people at the top usually want to stay there and have really good reasons why they have to be there, why it's natural, why it's right, and why you can't change things.
You talk about the, and I think Dr. Hicks brought this up, the four enlargements of American whiteness. And the first one begins in the Jacksonian era. What happened? What happened then?
Early in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, in order to vote, it wasn't enough just to be an adult white male. You had to have a stake in society, which was sometimes paying taxes, sometimes owning real estate, sometimes having a certain amount of wealth. But in the Jacksonian era, the fabled era of the common man, those restrictions fell away. And it became enough to be an adult white male. And so that's the first enlargement in which race takes the place of, grosso modo, class.
Or at least skin color takes the place.
No, because... Okay. People of different, I mean, people, Americans were all different colors.
Mm-hmm.
It was how you were classified by race. So there are plenty of so-called white people who were very brown, and there are plenty of so-called black people who were very white. So it was race, not color.
Okay, and how could they make that determination back then? They didn't have DNA.
You went to court. If you had to make the determination, you went to court.
Because
and there are lots and lots and lots of cases. So, for instance, even in the 20th century, Mexican Americans in Texas went to court to be declared white. Syrians went to court to be declared white because the naturalization laws of the United States, the early one in 1790, says you have to be white. It's the first insertion of the word white in American and federal law to naturalize. So if you want to naturalize, you got to prove you're white up until the Civil War. And the Reconstruction change said that, okay, you could be black or white, but what about all those other people? What about the Syrians? What about the Lebanese? What about the Mexicans? What about the Chinese? What about the Indian, as in South Asian? So all those people had to go to court to prove that they were white, and some of them did not succeed.
The second enlargement of American whiteness, as you write, are immigrants, when other people who were not native-born were included.
It's the Irish.
Okay, talk about the, because the Irish were, I'm Irish. We were persecuted. I don't know why.
Well,
but we were.
You belong to inferior race. If you were Catholic Irish, you belong to inferior race. So when your famine Irish ancestors came, and they were drunken and ugly and dirty, they belong to an inferior race.
And let me just say this, because I learned this from your book. I think I learned this from your book. Correct me if I'm wrong. That part of this perception of an inferior race is because of your economic status, your socioeconomic status.
That's about 99% of it.
Yes, and
that's a big deal.
No one those.
But wait. Let me get to this enlargement.
All right.
So mid 19th century, the famine Irish belong to an inferior race. But early 20th century, with other impoverished immigrants coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, the Irish get bumped up into a new classification called Nordic. And are you there?
I'm here. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere.
Right. And so Nordic is Northwestern European. And then the people from Southern and Eastern Europe are racialized as Mediterraneans or Alpines or the Hebrew race or the Slavic race and so forth, the Italian race. And the second great enlargement is when the Irish get into Nordic, newly coined. The third is the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s the realization that there's no such thing as a Jewish race and there's no such thing as races within the Caucasian race. And the last one is one that we're in the middle of now as a result of new immigration. So Hispanics, Latinos can famously be of any race. And the census is facing taxonomical meltdown because of the complications of that. And in addition, since the civil rights movement and the slow erosion of discrimination and segregation of African Americans, plus immigration from places like Haiti and Ghana and so forth, Black America has also changed. So we're in the middle of another opening, and you could call it a multicultural opening.
Now, you say we're not in a post-racial society yet. Will we ever be, particularly when we have your book, we have the Discovery Place exhibit across the street that talks about how there is no such thing as race, and it can be proven scientifically. There is no such thing as race, period.
Biologically.
Right.
Biologically, there's no such thing. But it's a very potent construction.
Wow. How has she influenced your work as a historian? I only have about 30 seconds, but how has she influenced your work, Dr. Hicks?
Well, I think professionally, just her production of scholarship and the wide range in which you have 7 books over 70 articles. It's not easy to categorize Dr. Painter's work, mm-hmm. but there are consistencies. And one is that she's engaged in addressing the complexity of the American past. And she also, again, forces us to question those ideas and arguments that we think we know so well, like American whiteness.
And you'll learn a lot about American whiteness and the history of white people by our other guest, Nell Irvin Painter. I want to thank her for joining us for the hour, as well as Dr. Cheryl Hicks in our studio here from UNC Charlotte. Thank you both. And really interesting.
You're very welcome.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.